Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hey, folks. Welcome to The Hang. In this episode, we are hanging with Peloton instructor Sam Yeo. Sam is a dynamic individual and extremely motivating. His story is pretty extraordinary. He spent his life deep into his two passions, the arts and fitness. 20 years in the entertainment industry, from working in the West End and television, and for 15 of those years, he also pursued his love for fitness and was an instructor. Sam talks to us about his time in both worlds, but also taking time out from everything and getting back in touch with his heritage and roots in Thailand. Sam pressed pause on a successful stage career early and became a monk for 9 months. That's where he got the nickname, Super Disciple. Well, welcome to The Hang, Sam Yeo Santvisuk. Did I say that all right?
Close.
Santvisuk.
Santvisuk. Santvisuk. Sam Yeo is cool.
I know we're going to go by Sam Yeo, but I just wanted to make sure we get that right. Sam Santvisuk.
Thai individuals have a very long surname.
But you just go by Sam Yeo now. Sam Yeo.
In the Thai culture, everyone has like a nickname. So Yeo is my nickname.
Right.
Which like, everybody calls me Yeo. And they don't call me by my real name. So everyone calls me Yeo. So Yeo was my stage name.
And were you born in Thailand or were you born in London, in England?
I was born in England, London. Yeah, in Chelsea.
In Chelsea. Okay. So I got connected with you through Mandy, my darling wife, who is now hooked on Peloton. And she's now part of the culture, the club, you know. And she was fascinated by your story. And when she was relaying it to me, it fascinated me. And then I started looking on your Instagram. You're very inspirational, very very hardworking. And then the more I got to know about you, your backstory is incredible. And we talked briefly today when we finally got to touch base. And what I found, I think people will be able to find compelling and perhaps be inspired by and connect to is, man, we have in you someone who was a monk, an artist on stage, and now you're a Peloton instructor.
Yes.
You've done a lot in a short space of time. So take us back. So born in Chelsea.
Yes. So I was born in Chelsea. My parents came over here from Thailand to work. And then like they were originally going to go back and get married. They were going to come here, save some money, go back and get married. And then my mom got pregnant with me. So at that time, there was a lot of opportunity more in the UK than in Thailand. So they decided to stay. So I was born in Chelsea and I've been very active, like fitness wise, since I could remember walking and running. My dad was a football coach. So he would just take me over to the park and kick a ball.
Right.
And it was like a bonding thing with my dad because, you know, sometimes men aren't best at talking about their feelings.
Right, yeah.
So, you know, that him taking the time to you know, teach me football was that bonding thing with us. So, like, I got into football and I was in the athletics team.
What were your sports back then?
So my sport in athletics?
Yeah.
Yeah, so mine was the 100 meters and the long jump.
Wow.
Yeah. The reason long jump. Yeah. I was like champion my long jump for the whole 5 years. So from athletics, I got into martial arts. So I did Taekwondo and Muay Thai for about 6-7 years.
That's amazing. Muay Thai is an incredible martial art. I'm like an armchair fan watching MMA all the time. I love it. And when you see the Muay Thai fighters, ooh, once they get that, get you in that clinch and that grip, it's like, watch out for those knees.
Because when I was growing up, I was learning Thai at the temple in Wimbledon.
Okay.
And they would bring me every Sunday to learn Thai. And then after I would learn, be at school, there was literally a Muay Thai class that they would be doing, which is literally in the car park. They'd be teaching people Muay Thai in the car park. And
wow.
And at the time, the Master Boon, he was one of the first people to introduce the UK to Muay Thai.
Mm-hmm.
He was at the temple, so I learned from him, and it was amazing. And then I got into, you know, when you kind of grow up, you watch all those movies like Jackie Chan, Jean-Claude Van Damme, all those things. So me and my friends will always kind of have those movie nights where we'll just like sit there watching the movies and then trying the moves and stuff like that.
Were they training with you as well at that point?
Yeah. So they would do Taekwondo with me.
And how old were you at this point?
I was probably about 12-ish, okay. I think. Yeah, about 12. And we would always train together. And then one of my friends, who was one of my close friends, he got into dance. So he started studying performing arts and dance. And I would kind of go and see his classes sometimes and then participate. And then, you know, I loved all the kind of, you know, the Michael Jackson, the Janet Jackson kind of dancing stuff. And he would teach me that. So I started doing dance at the same time. Mm-hmm. So I was doing art and dance. And then I got into performing arts college, where I did dance and drama and ballet and all that jazz.
And the kind of dance you were taking, were you going to, like, you know, the studios in London?
No, this was all in a college. So it's a whole proper course.
Okay.
Yeah, so I was doing tap and jazz and ballet and street and all. And learning about, you know, classical ballet history and modern ballet history. And then I auditioned for some fit schools. So I auditioned for like London Studios and Norfolk Contemporary Dance and Laban Centre, London Contemporary. And I got into all of them. And at that time, I was like, I was kind of just doing it as a hobby.
Yeah.
And then I kind of thought, oh, so these institutes kind of see something in me. So maybe there's something I should pursue. So I went to the Laban Center.
And were you, when you were doing it as a hobby, but you were passionate about it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I mean, it's that expression of movement that I just love.
Yeah. So when you auditioned for these schools, at that point, were you still thinking career or just you just felt like it was a natural progression? Just go along and you've been dancing, so I might as well audition and see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, it was something my teacher said that I should try and do.
Okay.
And just to see where it would go, because they saw something. I always wanted to be like an architect.
Wow.
I always wanted to be an architect growing up. I always had this like fantasy of designing and building my own house and living in my own house, you know? One of those things that I realized that there was a lot of maths involved and I wasn't very good at math.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I got into all these schools and I got a full scholarship from Laban. So I thought, okay, I'll go to Laban. So I went to Laban. I was like doing ballet and contemporary and just like sort of 6 to 7 classes a day. Really, because our training is like 7 years compared to 3 years.
I think about dancers and you're doing 6 or 7. That's like 6 or 7 workouts as well, right? And that's what, 5 or 6 days a week?
That's sometimes 6 days a week because on like Saturdays you'll come in rehearse for shows or rehearse for pieces and choreography as well.
Knowing what you know about fitness now, looking back then, imagine putting your body through that now. Like, would you not? I bet recovering wasn't even on your mind because you're constantly on the go.
Well,
back then.
I would have eaten better as well.
I find sometimes you don't need as much sleep or you forget to eat when you're really into something. You're like, wow, I've just been doing this for 12 hours or whatever it is that's kept you. Sometimes creativity, inspiration, that's food, you know, and it keeps you going.
Yeah.
So you're going through 3 years of those studies.
Yeah. So in my last term, it kind of dawned on me, you know, when you kind of think, oh, what do I do next? It was like, I had like, no, my last year and I saw that there was an audition for The King and I in the London Palladium with Elaine Page and Jason Scott Lee.
Yeah.
Yeah. Years ago. And it was in, you know, did you ever read The Stage when it was a newspaper?
Yeah, I remember that. I used to look for the auditions at the back.
Yeah, so you look through it and, you know, it's always nothing that I was suitable for. And then like this, there was one time I looked in there and it was like, you know, looking for contemporary dancers, which I was at the time, and looking for, you know, people of ethnic minorities. Like, oh my God, this is me. This is something I can actually go for instead of all the go-go dancers and the things that were in the stage at the time. So the weekend before I was going to audition, I was in a show and I broke my ankle.
Oh no.
The weekend before. So, yeah, I was in a show and I did a leap and I came and I literally landed funny. I twisted it. And then that was it. I was like, all right. So I was in a cast for like 3 months.
Dude.
So like 3 months later, I looked at the stage again and I saw that the king and I were looking for kids for the ensemble, for the children, for the king's kids. I thought, oh, they're still looking for kids. So I called Joe, I can't remember Joe, who was the children's casting director.
Okay.
So I literally pick up the phone, back in the day when you pick up the phone and you call people. And I left this really long message. He goes, hi, my name's Yo. I was going to audition 3 months ago for one of the dancing parts. And, you know, I was in an injury and I was just thinking if there's still auditions or they're still looking for people, you know, this is my phone number. Give me a call. And this is the children's director I left the message on. And then a week later, Debbie O'Brien, do you know Debbie O'Brien?
Yeah.
I love Debbie O'Brien. She literally called me up. She said, hi, Joe passed me your information. We have finals this week. Do you want to come? I was like, sure. And like, I hadn't danced properly for 3 months and I'd only done 2 weeks of getting back into it.
Right.
So I went to these final auditions. I think it was two or three of them. And at the time I didn't sing. So I was like, oh God, I need a musical theater song. What do I know about musical theater? And at the time, like all I knew was, the whole new world from Aladdin, from watching the Disney movie.
Okay.
Theater, isn't it? So I went to chapels in town and I bought them the sheet music and I asked one of the
chapels.
Yeah. I asked one of the pianists to play it for me and me to sing it, which was, I was terrible anyway. I was like tone deaf at the time, but I thought, oh, just in case they asked me to sing it.
Right.
So yeah, so I got through to the final and I sung and
so you sang A Whole New World?
A Whole New World, yeah. A Whole New World.
Just your bit, that's the beginning bit now.
Yeah. So yeah, I sang A Whole New World and then, I did the dancing and that.
Yeah.
And the last audition I did, I sang the song and luckily enough, like the dancers didn't have to sing. There was two different roles. And then a week later, they called me and said, oh yes, you know, we want you to join the cast. We're going to rehearse in a couple months. So I was like,
wow.
Yeah. So, but you know, I mean, at the time when you're young, you just get at it and there's no fear at the time, you know?
Well, listen, I'm still hanging on to you saying you saw something for the kids they were auditioning, but you're like, something told you to phone and just get your hand back in, put your hat back in the ring. And it took that initiative that, it was just the right amount of push to kind of like remind them of you just to see and just in case. And, you know, fortune favored the brave in this case. How did you feel when you first took your own bow?
It was insane. It was insane. It was like,
it's a crazy feeling, isn't it?
Yeah, because you walk out there and then the atmosphere hits you because, you know, and you don't have that security of like the other people outside of you. It's you, you know, standing there. It was pretty insane. Like my dad was really proud because he like, I don't know, he's really like, he doesn't say much, but he said to me, I'm proud of you. But yeah, so so from that point on, I started to learn to sing because one of the swings in the show, he said, well, you know, if you want your career to last, these are the things you need to do. First dance for a living, then sing for a living. And then if you're lucky, just talk for a living. Yeah, so that's kind of like in my, it's always been in my mind unconsciously, that's what I should do, you know. And very fortunately, I've been able to do that, you know, very fortunately. And then from like doing shows and stuff, I was always into fitness. I was going to the gym anyway. So, you know, you do the show in the evening, then you'll go out Soho, you go karaoke to 4 in the morning. Afternoon, you know what I mean? And then you go to the gym and then go to the show. I'm trying to drag all the singers out as well. So it wasn't until then I started doing like vocal lessons, vocal classes and lessons and stuff. just for my own peace of mind, just to feel a bit more confident going into maybe other auditions, which is what it's all about. It's confidence. You know, you can have, you know, you can sound amazing in your rehearsal room, but then if you don't have the confidence when you're standing there and your throat freezes up, then that's it.
And that's a real thing. That took me a long time. I still, when you get stress or those nerves, it's the first thing to shut.
Yeah.
And it's something that I don't know if it necessarily gets easier, but I think you learn to cope with it. You learn to prepare better, and
yeah,
everyone's different, right? So when you know yourself and you're able to navigate how you need to prepare, how you deal with your nerves, because it's caught me out a few times along the roads.
Mm-hmm.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
Yeah, I think up to the point when I was younger, I kind of felt I was just winging it. I was just winging it all the time
just winging it. And you feel like, man, someone's going to realize they made a mistake.
Someone's going to realize I can't do this. Yeah. So from that, I was able to do other shows. So I did like, my next big show was Fowley Modern Millie. So I was at Fowley Modern with Maureen Lipman, Amanda Holden, Craig Gubani was in there.
Did you enjoy that?
Oh, I loved it. It was for two reasons. One reason was because it was singing, but Dick Scanlon had wrote the script and changed it and modernized it. So my character, the younger Chinese character, got together with one of the second leading lady in it.
Okay.
Yeah. So it was very, especially at the time, this was like 12, 13 years ago, that something like that wasn't really steam in theater. Mm-hmm. The Asian guy with the Caucasian leading lady. So I did an amazing play called Martha Josie and the Chinese Elvis.
Where'd you do that?
I did it a few times. I did the Duke's Playhouse. And it overlapped with another production, which was going at the Sorsby Playhouse down south. And I was coming to the end of my run of the Dukes, and then 2 days before my end of the run, the Sorsby Playhouse called me and said, are you able to come and take over the role here? Because they were going to open in 2 days, but they had got rid of the guy who was playing my part. So they said, you know, are you available to come and take over? Literally, we open on Monday, and this was Thursday.
Whoa.
Yeah.
You go down, meet the cast first time, quick run through?
Yeah.
Did you?
Quick run through and...
Was it the same staging, same director, like same, whole new?
It was, the script was the same, but you know, every, you know, the actors are different, so they're giving you something different. And the stage was different, and...
Apart from learning the new staging, obviously that's nerve-wracking because, you know, there is safety issues and... especially when a company has already kind of like found their footing, but how exciting was it to kind of just see what's going to be thrown at you as new scene partners?
That was a great thing about it. It was because I'd done it for a couple of months and then you get used to the rhythms, don't you? Then you go somewhere else and it's a whole different, they're playing a whole different genre in a sense. You know, you gotta, you're doing jazz, now you gotta do hip hop, something like, you know.
So after that, are you still, after Salisbury, did you go back to any big like commercial musicals? Were you still touring?
So after Salisbury, I think after I toured for a bit, I think that's when I went to Thailand to become a monk.
There's a segue.
Yeah.
So what was that transition? Where did that come from?
So because I was sort of first generation in London, I've always kind of felt like I wasn't quite English enough, or I wasn't quite Thai enough. I was always kind of felt like I was in the middle.
I get you.
Do you know what I mean? And you kind of like a lot of the stuff that I would do towards my Thai heritage, I would not understand. So sometimes I'll go back to Thailand and there's things that my parents would be doing or my aunts would be doing, and I wouldn't quite understand why we were doing these certain things. It was just something as a kid I would just follow. And I kind of always intrigued of basically where I came from, you know, before me. And I remember when I was much, much younger, I think I must have been like 6. And I remember my dad taking me to where he grew up, and we're standing there and there's this river, and the river is like horrible. It's polluted at this time. It's black. And he said to me, "Oh, I used to fish in this river." I said, "What?" It's like, no. He said, "It was when it was cleaner. When I was younger, your age, I used to fish in this river. And, you know, we're fishing, what we caught we'd eat. You know, and if we didn't keep, you know, if we didn't catch anything, we probably wouldn't have any meat for that night." And my grandfather built a house by that river, out of like at the time, those huge leaves and wood, basically.
Yeah.
And that's where my dad grew up. And then afterwards, they upgraded to like sort of those metal slabs and stuff. And I remember standing there thinking, like, I had no idea that this is what I kind of came from before. And it was so funny. I'm like standing there. I always remember in my Reebok pumps and with my Game Boy in my backpack, my dad telling me about him growing up by this river and having the sense of being that I kind of had no idea that who I was or where I was from.
And how old are you at this moment?
I think I must have been at 7 or 8 around that time.
Okay.
I think that was the first huge culture shock, which really kind of, there was a huge divide, because all I'd known to that time was my UK upbringing, all my Western upbringing, and all the sort of convenient things I can have here. And it's always been sort of in the back of my mind. And then it got to a point where my cousin was getting married in Thailand. I thought, oh, he's getting married. He's going to become a monk just to kind of cleanse himself before he, you know, gets married. And then I thought, well, if I go with him, I can become a monk with him and he can teach me stuff in case I don't know. And I can do it for a couple of weeks at the time.
And this now, just so I'm up to date chronologically, this is after Salisbury's Playhouse.
I think it was after one of the tours I did. I can't remember what tours. It was one of the tours. You know, when you tour, you need to go to a temple after, don't you?
And during all that time, are you now questioning your, I guess, your heritage? It's been on your mind? Are you having conversations with people about it? Were you struggling it within yourself? Because I just want to bridge the gap between actor and you deciding to go to Thailand. So you're on stage, you're a stage actor, that's your profession. You're now going to go with your cousin with his sort of return before being married. So you're going with him to, how long was he meant to go back and become a monk before he gets married?
For, I think, 2 months. And I thought I would go there and I'll do it for a few weeks. I'll do it for a few weeks and then I'll come back.
So in support of him and also a bit of soul searching for yourself.
Yeah. And part of it was like, I thought, oh, you know, if there was anything I didn't understand, I could ask him.
Great.
You know, he could be my translator, my, you know, my monk whisperer, as you call it. So when I got to Thailand, he said, oh yeah, I'm going to a different temple than you. So we were being separated anyway.
Did your stomach drop? Were you like, what?
Yeah. When I landed, they told me, like, oh, we're going to different temples now. They don't want you to go to where I am because they're concerned that because you're going to be too far away. So they want me to stay in a temple in Bangkok where my family come and visit me, because they didn't want the UK city boy to go all the way into sort of the north of Thailand, because they were really, really good at the time. Yeah.
Were they worried about you and just not coping, or?
I think they're worried that I'll probably get bitten by a snake or something. Literally.
But not your cousin. Your cousin's good to go?
My cousin's good to go because he's born there. He knows all the danger signs.
Right.
So, yeah, I remember flying there. I got there on a Friday, and then there was a two-day ceremony, and then by Sunday evening, I was a monk.
What does that even, like, what does that mean? What did you do for the ceremony? And now that you're sat there, what's expected of you?
So from that point on, you know, it's, you know, fasting and, you know, learning and teaching and, you know, giving merit to people, and just literally like just being yourself, it's funny to say, it's just I had to be.
So you'd wake up in the morning, do you meditate when you start? Is there a group meditation?
Yeah, so we wake up about 4 in the morning, and then, you know, we would go to the temple and we'll do, you know, we'll chant and read, and then we'll meditate for an hour. Mm-hmm. And then from there, we'll go into the neighborhood. So we'll go into the neighborhood, we'll wait for people to offer us food and we'll bless them for the day. So we walk down the neighborhood, like in bare feet, literally no mm-hmm. shoes, and that's when you heard the story when the first day I cut my foot. I cut my foot on the very first day going okay. out, and I came back and it was a small cut, but you know, at the time it was huge, but it was bleeding. And I was like, oh my God, this is the first day. You know, how am I going to cope? You know, and then my mentor at the time, he said, you know, just tomorrow, take a different path. It takes you to where you need to go. I was like, yeah, I will do that. And I will do that because at the time when something happens, that anxiety, you lose sight of what you can control. And what I learned a lot about in the monastery is what you can focus on, what you can control, what you can't control. The things that we can't control that causes the fear and anxiety. Mm. And that's the things that we focus on too much. Yes. So that's one of the huge takeaways I've got from being a monk.
What a glorious lesson on day one being out as a monk. Now, let me ask you about the first time you meditated. Had you meditated prior to that? Was that part of your mental health, fitness regime?
No, it wasn't. It was the first time I'd ever meditated.
So the first time they got you to meditate, was that for an hour?
Yes, it was. It was for an hour. And like my mentor, he'll guide me through it, my breathing and just my focus. And he said, you know.
So throughout that hour, they're guiding you, they're coaching you?
Yeah, especially at the beginning when you're first new, they'll guide you and meditate. And then afterwards, they would kind of lead us to ourselves. That we seldom have time in silence to ourselves because there's so much going on. And especially these days, but back in those days, the same thing, there's so much going on. There's so many distractions, and it's, you know, to sit with just you and your thoughts is a very, at the beginning, was a very daunting thing. So I spend most of my day just like reading and learning and talking to individuals who had been monks for all their lives. Some of the guys there who'd been monks had been like left at the temple when they were younger. So the monastery was all they'd known. And I'd be talking to them, and I'd be fascinated with them, and they would be fascinated with me because they'd be like, "Oh my God, you're from a Western society. What's it like? Do you know the Queen? You know, things like that." You know?
What did they think of your musical career?
Well, it's so funny because from that culture, they kind of think it was a hobby. They were just fascinated by my experiences. They were fascinated by my experience growing up in the UK, and I was fascinated by their experiences in the monastery and in Thailand. I learned a lot just by talking to them about my heritage and my culture. It was so funny because I would have because I got a Superman tattoo. And they're like fascinated by that, a Superman tattoo. And, you know, when you're in the monastery, you address each other like disciples. So I go, so, you know, it would be disciple, Remy and you call me Disciple, probably call me Disciple Sam, but because I had a Superman tattoo, they will call me Disciple Superman.
Amazing.
I like, it's so funny. So the whole, this whole monastery of all these monks, I was known as Disciple Superman. So I was bringing my Western English upbringing into the temple, and it was those kind of two things coming together, and kind of felt like I was kind of writing my own narrative as I was going along, which is kind of the way I felt all my life, is you kind of write your own narrative when you're kind of a part of all these amazing things.
So how long are you there for now?
So I was there for, I think, nine months in the end.
Whoa, you were going for a couple of weeks. Wow, Sam. And then so a year there, and you're finding, what are you finding out about yourself at this point to get to the point where you're like, oh, I'm ready to leave?
Part of the reason I went there was just to understand more about where I was from. You know, there's a lot of, especially kids who are first generation, a lot of decisions made before we are born shape our lives now. You know, so sometimes I wonder myself, if my parents didn't move to the UK and I was born in Thailand, would I still have the same dreams? Would I still be the same person? Would I still have the same aspirations because I've been brought up in a different culture? Would I still love musical theatre? Would I be a huge comic fan? All these things. You know, and that was something that I always kind of thought back to, especially that moment when my dad said, look, this is where I used to fish. You know, yeah. And these decisions that my parents made before I was born kind of literally pushes you in a different direction. When you could have gone this way, you go in a different direction.
What do you think? Would that have shaped you differently? Because if you're not exposed to certain things.
Yeah. I mean, especially if I was born in Thailand, I don't think I would have got into the sort of the dance or the theatre side, because just in culturally, that's not really something that you do.
And are you communicating back home with your parents at all?
So my parents, my mom stayed in Thailand for like a month just to make sure I was okay. And she would, it's so funny because every morning then when she was there, I would walk to the neighborhood, I walked to my family home, and she'll be there and she'll offer me food, and I have to bless my mom, but I couldn't really speak or converse with her in that way, you know, like a father, like a son and a mother, because the whole dynamic had changed, because now I was a holy man. It's really strange.
Is this something you just found naturally? You took on a different sort of dialogue and position with your mother, or there's a set of rules that won't allow you?
No, it was my family who took a whole different dialogue with me.
Oh, right, of course.
They saw what I represented. It was very odd at the beginning, but then I got kind of used to how other people would be around me. So it kind of helped that way as well. So they kind of, it was like, oh, this is the norm. You know, they're very respectful. They're very respectful of monks and the space and how they dress, which was very alien to me. Coming from, especially in a Western society, and coming from like the entertainment industry, how some people are mostly in your face all the time and wanting your space and time, and this is being in a situation where they are respecting your space and time.
Well, what made you want to leave? What was there something in you that made you think, okay, I know what I need to do now?
So, I mean, part of it is because I miss my family, and part of it is because I kind of gave myself this kind of timescale to come back.
And what sort of commitment does the temple and being a monk expect of you when you arrive? Can anyone just go, or are you there? You have to be here for a certain amount of time, so you could.
No, I mean the commitment is your own personal commitment. I mean, most people, they would stay, I don't know, like 3 months. Most people would stay for whole entire lives.
Could I do that?
Yeah, you could. You could. It's. You could, and you know, it's the thing about Buddhism is it's great because it doesn't matter who you are, where you're from. It's you know, it's accepting. It's the teaching, and that the teaching that you learn, the teaching that you possibly pass on to someone else. You know,
my God, we need a lot of acceptance right now. And how did you find being back on stage after your experience?
It was very, very scary. Everything felt very noisy. I remember that. I remember noticing the noise everywhere, like even at home or just walking down the street, there was just so much noise. I really noticed the way people spoke to each other as well. how most people, you speak to each other, but you're not really listening. And it was very different from coming from an environment where all everyone wanted to do was listen to you.
When you listen to someone, you empower them. And also it's, you learn more, you take in more, you understand better. And it's sometimes, it's, I guess, you know, a lot of the work is done with when you don't talk.
And so, yeah, most of communication is done non-verbally, isn't it, as well? When you're around someone in the way they are with you, the way they look at you, and, you know. But I think especially in sort of the entertainment industry, as you know, a lot of people, they, you know, we always want to be heard as well, don't we? We're worried sometimes that if we're not heard, we're not seen, and we're not kind of validated in that sense sometimes.
As you're going further into the tour now, 6 months, 7 months, are you enjoying it? Are you still finding the buzz of being on stage, or has your experience as a monk now thought, this ain't right? Is the noise still bothering you?
No, it definitely had changed. Now I had a bit more awareness of myself and a bit more awareness of just who I am, you know, and where I was from and how to navigate now in my place between, you know, not being too English enough and not being Thai enough. Mm. You know, it's all balance. I think so many first generation people, they struggle with that because it's like, where should I be? Where should I go? You know,
you felt you found a balance in your identity in both, you're saying?
I felt that I'd started it, but I think it's always been a ongoing evolution. It's always ongoing evolution. You know, it's so funny. It's like, you know, it's that saying, like, when you're in your 20s, you think you know everything. But you get to your 30s, you realize you didn't know anything in your 20s and you need to start learning now. And now in your 40s, you think, okay, I know things now, but I'm getting too old now. But yeah, so, I mean, I sort of got more into fitness and stuff afterwards as well. I was getting to the point when I was tired of waiting. As performers, we're professional waiters. We kind of wait for the agent to call us, then we wait in the waiting room, then we wait to hear back, then we wait to hear the agent calls. But then, you know, we're always waiting. And then if we're not doing those things, we're waiting tables, basically.
Professional waiters.
So I kind of got to the point when I kind of wanted to try and take a bit more control. So the coaching really helped. And I was kind of wanting to move a bit more away from musical theater.
Okay. So did you get your level one, like as a personal trainer, and you started getting all your accreditations for that?
Yeah, so I started to do my accreditations. So I got my level three. So I was personal training and teaching classes, but I after a while I transitioned more to teaching classes and group classes because it still gave me the freedom to do the acting jobs.
Right, okay.
You know, if I had to go off and do an acting job, I could get cover for my classes. And I started to try and take more control in that sense, is that I started to push my training, my personal training and my group classes more. And it got to a point maybe two, three years ago where my acting jobs would be my thing on the side and my training jobs would be the things that would support me and give me the freedom. You know, I would be teaching like 20 classes a week, 20 hours a week, and that would pay me double, which it did doing an ensemble in the West End, and gave me the freedom as well. So, you know, and I was very lucky to be quite good at that as well, and have a lot of, you know, a lot of big gyms and the big studios wanting me to teach for them. So, I mean, that's how Peloton found me, is when I was teaching in these studios.
Peloton found you?
Yeah, Peloton found me, yeah. Peloton approached me, yeah.
Through what, social media, through?
So, like, I had no idea who Peloton were at all.
They're blowing up now, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, they've been huge in America for so long. In America, they've been huge, and I had no idea because, you know, for me, my coaching stopped when I left the studio. I'm not a social media person to post things. So Peloton are looking for two new instructors. We're looking in the UK and in the US for two new instructors. So they literally looked at about 400 different instructors in the UK and US, 400. And the first thing was to look at your social media profile. So even though I wasn't on social media much, I was very fortunate that I had just something.
Right.
So my coach used to tell me, you didn't have anything, but what you had intrigued us. Because what you had was not about fitness. What you had was about you. So, that's one of the things as well, is that a lot of people, especially in this day and age, they're trying to be like everyone else. But what they forget is what they have, which no one else is their own uniqueness.
Yeah, there's no one, be yourself. Everyone else is taken, as they say, right? Yeah,
that's right. And he said that, you know, what you had was, that really intrigued us. So they put me like on narrowing me down to the last 200, basically. And then we'll have discussions. It's basically like a casting. They'll have a discussion and they'll discuss this person, that person, you know, and then they try and find people who, you know, not only great coaches, but have something unique about them. And then afterwards they would scout and go to the classes and see what they were like teaching. So then they would do that. And then once again, they'll narrow it down until they had like 8 people who they got in contact with from the 400. So I had a message from the VP of Peloton in the UK. He messaged me on my Instagram, and I never, ever, ever, ever checked my Instagram or direct messages and stuff. So that message was on there for like a month before I even checked.
Really?
Yeah, it was on there like a month. I was like, oh, I was checking. It's like, oh, this, you know, I didn't even know this section was there. And it's like, oh, I was just checking it, and then like, oh, this guy being Peloton, what's that? And I literally Googled it. I was like, is this guy for real? And I Googled it, and he said, and I saw how big it was in America. And I said, oh, and I sent him an email saying, oh, sorry, I literally just checked my phone today. And then he sent me a message, oh, you know, do you want to meet for coffee and we'll just have a discussion? And then I met him, and he literally told me, you know, that they've been coming to my classes for the last 2 months, and they really, really liked me, and you know, would I be interested in maybe seeing to take this further? And they tell you about the company and you know what they're all about, what they were trying to achieve, and so he said come in for a meeting with the producer. So I went in for the meeting with the producer, and he's like, hi, you know, da da, just telling about myself, and they said, oh, we're just gonna put you on camera and just ask you questions. That's it. See how you look on camera. See what energy you give out on the camera. So literally that was the first round, literally. Well, not the first round, but maybe like the 12th round that instructors go through. It's that first meeting. And then that gets sent to America, and they have the whole discussion in America.
Wow.
Yeah. And then, you know, then I kind of got through that round. And then the next round, I said, well, come back in, you know, we really like to, you know, teach a song. Show us, teach a song, see how you are. So literally got on the bike, so choose a song. I was like, Bon Jovi, Living on the Prayer. They put it on, I just, yeah.
This is just you and a couple people behind the table?
No, this is me and literally in the studio, literally me by myself in the studio. And then I can hear, so the control rooms and the other rooms, that they talk to me through the PA system.
Oh.
Yeah.
And forgive me, where are you now? In a London studio?
Yeah, so in our London studio, yeah.
Okay.
So then I did that, and then it's the same as a casting process, and you kind of forget about it, wait to hear back. And they said, oh, you know, do you want to come in? Can you teach like a whole 20-minute class? So I did that, and then.
But is anyone taking a class with you?
No, just me.
So you're talking as if the room is full to inspire the room, but there's nobody in there?
Nobody in the room, and just the cameras. So I'm like addressing, it's like the first time I'm using cameras. And with the Peloton class, the cameras, they change. So there's a red light. So you're talking to this camera, and then the red light will change. So you've got to address this camera, and you're constantly being directed by someone in another room.
Through an earpiece?
No, just through something.
You follow the dot.
Follow the dot, like a cat. Follow the dot.
Wow.
And this is all, and you kind of do this kind of, you know, 80% of it's improvised as well. what you do on the platform, 80% is improvised.
Really?
Yeah. 80% is improvised. It's just you. Just, yeah.
When you go in, so when you go to do a class, yeah. You've set your playlist up, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's preset.
So yeah, so the playlist is set and the program, the fitness program is set.
So you're doing a 20-minute audition though.
Yeah. So I did my
audition.
And then, you know, then they say, oh, you know, great, thanks. You know, and then I went away. And then suddenly they'll call me and message me. So you got through to the next round.
So the next. Oh my God.
Yeah. So the next round is like literally a bunch of interviews. So I'm having interviews with the people in New York.
I had less auditions for Fanta. Peloton is throwing you through the ringer.
Yeah.
So you're having interviews on camera with FaceTime or Skype with people in New York?
Meeting the team, the content team, and some of our head instructors, they're talking to me. They're literally kind of trying to feel me out what I'm like, you know. And then literally I had about 5 or 6 interviews.
Holy crap.
Different times. I had like 5 or 6 interviews. From the point where they contacted me and to the point where they offered me the job, it was from April to I think the beginning of August.
Well, a short, like a temporary contract?
No, that was the time it took from when I met.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
And going for the auditions and then all the different interviews. And then when they offered me the contract was in August. So it took that amount of time.
Wow.
And then, of course, previous that was the month they were scouting me out. So
was that the training ground or do you then now go?
Now the training, that's just how to get through the door.
So how is the training? Is it here or did they fly out to New York?
It's both. So I did about 3 months, two months training in London, just to get used to everything. And then I went over and I was in New York for 3 months, just learning. Yeah, I think the whole thing was 3 months. It was about a month here in the UK and about 2.5, maybe 3 months in the New York.
So almost 6 months of training.
Yeah.
Full time, or are you still doing your other studio work?
No. So that means I kind of had to unfortunately had to leave that studio because this is a whole different ball game. It's very hard. It's like I described to my mates, like if Barcelona asked you to play for them.
Yeah.
It's like, oh yeah, you don't say no. And at that point, I kind of felt out who Peloton were and what they were in America. And when I went to America, you can see how huge it is and how, like, the instructors are, people just love the instructors and what the instructors do for them. It's on a kind of whole different level. And it was just kind of so funny being there in New York. I couldn't tell people that I was training.
Really?
Yeah, so I had to be kind of literally on the down low all the time. I couldn't tell people I was training, that I was going to be the next Peloton instructor because there's, you know, because it's, the community, the Peloton community are so committed and love the instructors. They want to know so much about the company and what we're doing. And they try to find out who the instructors are and stuff before.
So they're waiting for the big press release to announce you.
So they're waiting for literally the press release where they literally just announced this is our new instructor, boom. Because the last 3 instructors of Peloton were outed before they were announced. They were found out before through, I don't know, social media or whatever, they were cycling instructors, yeah.
I bet hashtag Peloton was going crazy with all the gossip.
November the 13th was my first live class. So I got announced as the instructor on November the 11th. And then that's when everyone knew, oh my God, it's a new Peloton instructor. And I was like, I kind of kept my profile on the download the whole time. So no one knew that I was coming out.
Wow. And so your first class, you're in a studio with cameras, obviously no one else there or at that point?
Yeah. So at this point I had people basically like an audience, but the audience was like, it was some the other instructors in New York had flown in as well, and we had our great UK instructors are there, and just like our team that really that helped me through, and I had my best friend and my other half there. It's like you know, it's just like a show, you know, like a press night. You invite people you know,
but they're the ones taking the class.
They're the ones taking the class. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's like basically like press night. yeah. So that's my like. That was November the 13th was my first class, and then you know I've been there six months now, and 6 months this month, and we've had 2 months where we had to be off because of what's going on. So, but within the 6 months I've been there, I just heard today that like over 1.2 million people had taken my classes in those 6 months.
Are they reaching out to you on social media as well?
Yeah, I mean like every day. I mean I went
well as. That's how I met you. Mandy did. She reached out to you.
Yeah. I mean, because I went from someone who didn't know social media at all to learning how to do social media.
Well, your social media is it's curated really beautifully. It's very inviting and inspiring. There's some beautiful stuff on there.
Thanks. Yeah. I mean, we have the whole social media team. I have like a social media manager helps me think of ideas that good. Me, not just things that you just post for no reason, but things that are me, things that they think that can connect with the community, things that I'm comfortable sharing. And, you know, just for me, it's all about trying to be relatable. Because sometimes when you're on these platforms or on the stage, you don't seem relatable to people. And it's the relatability which is going to make you last, I think.
Yeah, that's very true. They got to, it's all about connection, right? Yeah. If they don't relate or connect in a way, then terrible pun, but they won't come along for the ride, right?
and you know, a lot of people reach out and they connect. I mean, I get it. It was quite overwhelming at the beginning. It's like, oh, and how do I handle all this? And you know, do I reply to everyone? Or because, you know, like my messages are like full. Like I'll do a class and like this week I did a class and it was like nearly 2,000 people on the leaderboard. Like doing it live. So, you know, and some of those people reach out to me and say, oh, that was a great class, all that. It's impossible to reply to everybody, unfortunately. But,
yeah.
You know? But I'm always grateful for anyone who takes my classes or anyone that messaged me. Even if I read it and after a week or so and don't get time to reply back. But it's nice how one of the things is that a lot of, like Asian mothers and fathers have reached out to me saying, oh my God, my child loves you. It's lovely seeing a reflection of him on something like this. He started X, Y, he's starting to do these things just because he can, it's the thing that I never had growing up in fitness.
Wow. He felt represented, you're saying?
Yeah, they felt represented. It was, that's what really, really hit me with that. You know, I'm now potentially giving someone something that I never had growing up. You know,
that's amazing.
So, I mean, you know, the class and the, you know, the program is one thing, but there's a whole different thing, you know, especially because it's such a global thing. You've got to think that some people have never probably interacted with someone who looks like me or knows anyone who looks like me. And now I'm in their homes. Given exercise and maybe their kids, the first time they see an Asian person is my face. So, you know, it's trying to represent something that is true, you know, without reinforcing the stigmas and stereotypes as well. Mm. Sometimes, especially coming from, you know, the entertainment industry where most of the roles I went up for were very stereotypical, and very stigmatized. I'm very conscious of delivering a narrative where it's, you know, it shows Asian representation in a positive light and as a person. So the heritage, mm-hmm. heritage is part of you, but it's something you draw onto. It's the person that you see. People reach out, especially just like, oh my God, I can't believe. Yeah. It's really one of.
You look and you sound like you're at home there and that you're really enjoying the position that they've and the platform they've given you, and good on Peloton, as a risk of sounding like this is a Peloton advert. It's not, it's your story, but good on them. And so if I'm taking your class and Mandy lets me use the bike and I sign in, you'll see that I'm, cause you see who's taking your class, right?
But yeah, so when we're teaching, we have sort of the tablet, and we've got to remember the class that we're teaching, the fitness program. We got to remember the cues on the music. We got to remember the cadence resistance that you're going. We got to engage with the leaderboard. So the leaderboard is going flickering with all the people. So you engage with people, milestones, and then you engage in the camera. And then we're following in the camera in the direction of the camera. And if it's a heavy scripted class, we've got to remember what we're talking about sometimes. If there's something you want to say, or some joke or some corny line that I always say. And then you've got to remember to be entertaining and motivated. And this is all done while you're exercising and your heart rate's up about 70 to 80% of its max.
So that sounds, well, you're a better man than me. I'm looking forward to taking your class, but I'll leave it to you to lead it. So how should people keep it? I think, well, definitely people should check out your Instagram. Mm. It's super inspiring. And
Yo, I am Samyo.
Yo, I am Samyo. I like that.
Yeah.
Well, before I let you go, can I ask you two quick questions?
Yes.
What made you smile yesterday?
What made me smile yesterday? I was looking at an old video of my nephew when he was younger. He's like 12 now, and it was a video of him at my brother's workplace, and he was 3 and he was mopping the floor and he was singing. His muffin foot, as it was just the smallest thing, it was a muffin foot. It was like in his own world, he was mopping the floor, feeling like he was like really contributing to my brother's work. And
that's beautiful.
Yeah.
And first thing that comes to your mind, but a childhood memory. First nice childhood memory that comes to your mind.
It's got to be playing football with my friends. Playing football with my mates. Like that was, yeah. It was every day we used to play, and yeah, we used to, back in the day when fences used to be wood, we used to kind of climb over the wood fence and literally play until there was no sun left, and just, especially that summer reminds me of playing football with my friends and walking back in your t-shirt and it's still hot, and
Well, Sam, I could speak to you for hours. It's so easy to speak to you. I just think you're amazing and super excited to take your class. I think you're an amazing guy.
Oh, thank you. I've been a big fan of yours for quite some time. The first time I saw you was as Chris at Chris on the national tour of Saigon.
Really?
Yeah, years ago. And I saw you in Love Never Dies. And yeah. So when Mandy messaged me on my post, I was like, oh, I recognize the name. I was like, oh, yeah. And we probably got lots of mutual friends as well in the industry.
I think we do, and I hope we can hang out when this is all, when we're all able to do that. And I'm honestly, we got to train together.
Yeah,
you're an inspiration, brother. And hopefully, maybe one day the theater will call, your heart will want to get back on stage just for a little bit,
maybe.
And we can share that thing together. But for now, Peloton, yo, I'm Samyo on Instagram. Good hanging with you, brother.
Thank you, my pleasure.
Thanks for hanging with Samyo and myself, folks. I really hope you enjoyed this episode. I had a great time getting to know Sam. Really excited to get into a class with him and train with him and take one of his Peloton classes. All the best. The Hang is produced by Dory Beristein and Alan Seals from the Broadway Podcast Network. You can find me online at epn.fm/The Hang. Don't forget, you can connect with me on Instagram and Twitter at Ramin Karimloo, on YouTube, A Roaming Iranian, or my Facebook page, Official Ramin Karimloo. Music for my podcast is by my friends and one of my favorite bands, The Dives. Please check them out at their website, thedivesmusic.com. That's thedivesmusic.com, where you can get to know them, hear their incredible music, get links to all their socials, and most importantly, their tour dates, where you can find out where you can see and hear them live. They are truly a great band, and they are phenomenal live. Check them out.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.